You're listening to KTOO's Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, and last week I got the opportunity to interview Shankar Vedantam. He's host of NPR's Hidden Brain, which we air Saturdays right here on KTOO at 3 o'clock p.m. We had a great conversation about Alaska, glaciers, climate change, psychology, and I would like to play the interview for you right now. Enjoy. Shankar, you might be one of the few NPR show hosts that has actually visited Juneau, Alaska, and that was back in 2016, right?
That's right.
And then you created a Hidden Brain segment called Why Our Brains Weren't Made to Deal with Climate Change. I was wondering if you'd be willing to give me a recap of what you remember of what happened when you visited the Mendenhall Glacier.
Sure, of course. This was actually supposed to be a vacation with my family, and it's been a point of some contention with my family that whenever I go on vacation, I end up doing work. But it seemed like too good an opportunity to pass up, honestly, because when I visited the Mendenhall Glacier, you know, we heard about how the glacier has been receding for the last several years, very dramatically, in fact. And it seemed like that was a perfect case study to talk a little bit about climate change, but also to talk to some of the tourists who were coming to see the glacier and see what they made of the glacier's retreat. And in some ways, it provided a little microcosm of how the country thinks about climate change issues when they're confronted by something that they're seeing in the ground, on the ground right in front of them.
Right. And I just, as a side note, like many Juneau residents, really excited to hear John Neary's voice in that segment. He's quite the fixture around here.
Yeah, he was amazing. And I have to say that was part of the reason I wanted to do something. I didn't have any of my audio recording equipment with me, actually. So that entire much of that entire episode was recorded on my phone, which of course makes the audio producers working with me pull their hair out to imagine that I would do that. But this was what I had. And of course, I was on location. And between the concerns of my audio producers and my family, that was the best that I could do.
I thought the audio sounded surprisingly good. I figured it was recorded on a phone. So looking back, that was 3 years ago. Is there anything that you would add today, 2019, to some of your ideas about why climate change is hard for people to literally wrap their brains around?
Sure. And I think in some ways that episode was eye-opening for me as well, because I think when you look at a phenomenon like the receding glaciers, It is hard to sort of know what to make of it, because there are clearly glaciers that are receding, but there are also some glaciers that are advancing in Alaska and other parts of the world. And of course, it's only when you step back and look at the big picture that the data seem really quite clear that overall there has been a warming of the Earth's climate, and this warming is having significant effects on many, many different parts of the ecosystem of the Earth. But from a psychological perspective, I thought it was very interesting, because when you see something before you, one of the things that you want to do, that we all want to do as human beings, is to make sense of what's going on. That's what happens. You know, when the fire alarm goes off at work, we turn to one another to ask what's happening, because we want to explain this phenomenon that's happening. And that's what happens when we see natural phenomena as well. We ask, what is it that's behind this? And what I found very revealing in the interviews that I did with many people who came to see the Mendenhall Glacier is how they were struggling to try and understand what it meant that the glacier was receding, how they tried to make sense of it. We've talked with many experts on Hidden Brain who've talked about how climate change in some ways presents uniquely difficult, not just scientific problems, but psychological problems. Because if you think about the challenge of climate change, you're talking about changes that unfold, first of all, fairly slowly, because they unfold, you know, over a matter of years or decades or centuries, not necessarily over hours or minutes. Many of the changes that we are most concerned about are actually off in the distance. Many of the changes, of course, are on us today, but some of the worst impacts of climate change might not be seen for 15, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And our minds are not very well designed to pay attention to things that change very slowly, that unfold over time, and where the effects are not seen for many decades in the future. In many ways, our minds, our brains were designed by evolution to pay attention to problems in the here and now, you know, to solve problems like, I'm hungry, where do I go get food? Or I'm thirsty, where can I find water? Or I'm in danger, how can I run to safety? To solve problems in the immediate present. Climate change really requires us to put on a different hat, if you will, to say the things that we should be most concerned about are things that are going to occur maybe 50 years or 100 years in the future, maybe even when I'm no longer alive myself, but that can affect future generations. And they present uniquely difficult psychological challenges because in many ways our minds are not designed to cope with problems like that, which is why when you look at many parts of the world today, you often see apathy in the face of mounting evidence about the reality of climate change.
In that segment, you suggested that solutions to acceptance of climate change aren't necessarily scientific or the presentation of scientific evidence, maybe not psychological either, but cultural. Do you still agree with that? And are you seeing any signs of this shift happening with humanity, with our thoughts?
So there's a great paradox here, which is that the evidence for climate change is coming to us from science and from scientists. And when people aren't listening to what they say, the response of many scientists is to say, well, let's do another study and let's do an even more comprehensive study, or let's look at this in a new domain. And perhaps this latest study or the newest piece of evidence will convince you. But of course, if the first 355 studies have not convinced you, it seems unlikely to me the 356th study is going to have this dramatic effect on your mind, which leads to the idea that in many ways what you really want is sort of not so much to, you know, to beat people over the head with evidence. It's not that evidence isn't important. It's very important to generate the evidence for climate change. But to actually see change on the ground, you might actually have to come up with other techniques. You might have to think of psychological techniques that get people involved with the issue. In many ways, I think some of the debates over climate change are academic debates. And what I mean by that is people say, well, I don't believe the data. And other people say, well, let me show you more data. And then you end up having an argument about the evidence or the quality of the evidence or what the evidence means, as opposed to saying, how do I actually get people to change what it is they're actually doing? I remember one of the people I met when I was at the Mendenhall Glacier was a gentleman from Southern California. I think his name was Terry Lambert. And he was deeply skeptical that the receding of the glacier meant anything. He wasn't sure that it was actually necessarily an indication of climate change. But he also said, you know, even if it is an indication of climate change, what am I going to do about that? I'm one person. What can I do that would affect how the Earth's climate changes? And in fact, this is one of the other psychological barriers with climate change, because what any of us can do as individuals probably has very little effect on the global climate as a whole. But one of the things I found really revealing was when Terry talked about problems happening in his own backyard. He talked about how there were changes happening in the ocean around him in Southern California, and he's a diver. And he talked about how he himself had gone on many dives to try and protect the ocean environment in which he himself lived and he himself felt an ownership stake in. And in many ways, that little example gives us insight into how we might come up with a more productive way to talk about climate change. So rather than having arguments with one another where we're trying to persuade each other about the rightness of our views or the wrongness of your views, it might be more effective to focus more on what's happening at the local level, to say, everyone wants clean air, everyone wants clean water, everyone wants a healthy ecosystem around where you live. How do we help you get what you want in your local ecosystem? And in many ways, that might be a more effective way to get more people to act, because everyone can agree on what happens in the local environment around them, even if they have disagreements on a national or global scale.
Well said, yeah. And speaking of local environments, the village of Newtok here in Alaska is in the news right now. Did you happen to take in the story about this village being some of the earliest climate change transplants here in North America?
No, I'm not familiar with the story.
Yeah, some of the village is being relocated due to rising sea levels and erosion issues. And it's official. These are climate change transplants here in North America. And I'm sorry, I know you haven't seen the article, but I did want to ask, how do you think this will affect the residents socially and culturally and psychologically going forward?
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't know the specifics of the story, so I really can't say how that will affect local residents. But I think climate change in general poses these challenges to people, because around the country, you know, there are many parts of the country where sea level are rising and significant portions of the American population, you know, lives within 100 miles of the coast. And, you know, what does it mean for them to basically live in an era when sea levels are rising all around them? And I think many communities are grappling with this. And of course, these involve, you know, business challenges and technological challenges as we cope with these changes. But they also involve psychological challenges, because at some point, you know, you have to have the psychological moment where you sort of say, you know, I can't ignore what's actually happening around me. What's happening is real, and it's actually going to affect me in my lifetime, and I might need to actually do something about it. I'm afraid I don't know enough about the local situation that you're describing to comment more on that, but I think this question that you're asking is much more than what's happening just in Alaska. It's really happening across the United States and across the world.
Thank you. I know our listeners, this is the last question. I know our listeners would be interested to know how the rest of your trip went. Did you visit other glaciers? Did you continue the conversation about climate change with your fellow vacationers or other Alaskans?
Yes, I did. In fact, as I went the rest of the trip, it wasn't a very long trip. We spent most of the trip in Juneau and then took the Alaskan ferry down a little bit and saw a couple of other cities as well. One of the highlights on that trip for me was to take a helicopter to the top of one of the glaciers. And that was really a surreal experience to be standing on one of the glaciers. It was really otherworldly. I remember sort of bending down and drinking some water off a glacier, and that felt really special to drink water that in some ways, you know, had never sort of really been seen by human beings before, felt incredibly special. And I think one of the great things about visiting Alaska, and I've been a few times and I feel this every time I've come to visit, is that being in Alaska actually puts you in contact with nature in ways that I don't think many people experience. There is something that you see when you're in Alaska that's very hard to see when you're in the lower 48. You know, you really have a sense that you're a very small creature on a very big planet, and you have a sense of how you fit into the larger scheme of things. And in many ways, this might be a completely unrealistic idea, but I suspect more people would have a deeper appreciation of the Earth and the climate and their responsibility to it if they happen to visit states like Alaska.